WIOX is supported by Home Goods of Margaretville, corner of Main and Bridge Streets in Margaretville, New York. Now carrying spices, flour, jams, mustards, coffee and tea, organic vegetables and fruits, and local eggs, milk, cheese, and baked goods. And, of course, cooking basics and tools of the trade for everyone at home. Home Goods of Margaretville. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 11 to 5, 845-586-4177 or hgom.net.
WIOX is supported by Kimchi Harvest at East Branch Farms on Route 30 at Briggs Road in Roxbury. Experienced growers of organic vegetables and herbs selling authentic homemade Korean kimchi and banchans. East Branch Farms. Information and ordering for pickup at 607-326-6177 or eastbranchfarms.com.
WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, a critical access hospital offering comprehensive medical services, including emergency, cardiology, imaging, rehab, and a retail pharmacy. 845-586-1800.
You're listening to WIOX Roxbury, New York. Community radio in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM. Serving Roxbury, Margaretville, Halkettsville, Halkett Center, Hobart, Gilboa, Conesville, Stamford, South Courtright, North Blenheim, Faltenham, Schoharie, Middleburg, Pine Hill, Highmount, Shandaken, Fleischmann, Venetia, Jefferson, Huntersfield, Windham, Watsonville, Meredith, East Meredith, Merredale, Big Indian, Butts Corner, Kelly's Corner, Bovina, Grand Gorge, Andes, Arkville, Drybrook, Break a Beam, Barkaboom, Arena, Prattsville, Downsville, Summit, New Kingston, Denver, Vega, and everywhere else at WIOXradio.org.
This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. You are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and cable MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the radio.fm app. And, John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Also, here is Zane Lawyer from the Catskill Forest Association. Let me see if I can get your mic to work. Something's going on over there. Yeah?
Oh, coming through here?
Yeah, try your try maybe another headphone. All right? Don't know what's going on there. So, John, how's it going?
Oh, things are good. I've been cutting a lot of trees lately.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How come? What are you doing that for?
Well, there was four blue spruce trees, all of them in decline, dying from the bottom up, about 25, 30 feet tall, planted much too close to a house, and it was time to go.
Yeah.
So that's what I did last weekend. Cut them down, built a fire, burned them up.
Yeah.
They're gone.
All right. Good job.
Thanks.
Zane?
Am I coming in now?
Yeah, I got you now. Good. I don't know what happened.
Something I saw was pretty neat. I've read about it before, but I haven't encountered it yet. It's a living stump. I was at a member's property, and he had a bunch of hemlocks there, and one of them was cut recently. I couldn't help but notice that it had a lot of callus wood growing around the edge of it.
Yeah.
So I guess for some reason the root systems are still funneling nutrients to that stump, and it's just continuing to grow.
That's amazing. I mean, it's amazing when you see a branch that's 4 inches in diameter heal over, let alone, you know, a whole stump. But, yeah, tonight's show is, we should probably get into it, is Best Trees for Home, Urban, and City Landscapes in the Northeast with Professor Don Leopold. Dr. Donald J. Leopold earned his Ph.D. in forest ecology from the Purdue University in 1984, his M.S.F. in forest ecology from University of Kentucky in 1981, and B.S. in ornamental horticultural and nursery management from the University of Kentucky in 78. He joined the Faculty of Environmental and Forest Biology at the SUNY ESF, that's a College of Environmental Science and Forestry, in 1985. And since 85, he has been teaching the oldest and largest dendrology, study of trees, courses in the U.S. In 98, he was promoted to Distinguished Teaching Professor. He was the chair of the Department of Environmental and Forest Biology from 06 to 2019, and he has published over 70 peer-reviewed papers and 7 books, including the Textbook of Dendrology, Trees of New York State, and Wildflowers of the Adirondacks, has over 130 tree videos, each about 2 to 3 minutes long on YouTube. And let me see if I can get Dr. Leopold on. Are you there?
Hey, Ryan, how are you?
Good. How have you been?
Just fine. We finally got some winter up here, and it's feeling and looking like winter after quite a mild winter up to this point.
Yeah. How much snow did you all get up there?
Yeah, you know, we're still about 40 inches below normal. So in Syracuse, you know, we've only had probably 30 inches by now. But and they always get a lot more just north of us. But in the city here, it's been pretty minimal.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, we got 3 to 4 inches. I don't know, right, John? What'd you get in Delaware County?
About 3 inches. Yeah. Not a huge total.
Nothing crazy.
No.
So let's get right into it. First of all, what got you into trees anyway, Dr. Leopold?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what it was, because as a boy, I think I spent as much time looking for fossils and chasing butterflies and catching fish, and I don't know if I spent as much time focusing on plants, but I took the dendrology course at Kentucky as an undergrad when I first got there, and it was just something about the topic that really, really clicked, and so that's really where I've been focusing for, gosh, about 50 years since then.
Yeah, no kidding. So I saw your presentation at the International Society of Arboriculture New York State Arborist Conference last week, and I asked you to come on, and we're glad that you've come on. And tonight's topic is Best Trees for Home, Urban, and City Landscapes in the Northeast. So what are attributes of good trees?
Well, for just general planting, probably the most obvious thing is that the tree should do something besides just have leaves, because, you know, there are a lot of trees that have pretty good spring wildflower displays or flowers later in the year, and some that have pretty interesting fruit, and then some that you can even eat, which is really neat, and then some with outstanding fall color. And there are some trees that do it all, and there are some trees that do none of it. And so I think, you know, if you're going to spend anything, a penny on any tree, you should at least make sure that it's going to do something that's going to enhance your landscape. Of course, you know, the tree has to be cold hardy, and that's, you know, a challenge at the higher elevations in New York and further north. There still are a lot of trees that are perfectly cold hardy, even up in northern New York. So it's not like, you know, you only have a choice of 10 trees. It only gets really challenging if you get up in northern Minnesota or further north, where, you know, you don't have a lot of choices. You know, the tree should be strong. There are some trees that are notoriously weak-wooded, and they're typically the ones that grow really fast, and there's a trade-off. You know, you see some advertisements sometimes in the newspaper for poplars that grow 30 feet in 1 or 2 years. Well, that sounds great if you're looking for instant shade, but that tree's not going to probably last long.
I just got I just got 5 of them down in the last 2 weeks. They were huge. They must have been over 30 inches at the base.
you know, and they get that big in just 50 years. It's an amazing tree. And so for, like, wetland restoration purposes or for any type of land restoration, that's a pretty good thing to think about, for instance, function. But, you know, in the landscape around a house or a park, there are trade-offs. And the other issue is that, you know, when people about 100 years ago thought, well, gee, I want to plant a tree, the tree that came to mind always was American elm. And American elm, although there are some varieties resistant to the Dutch elm disease, they're not resistant to the other disease that is just as lethal, maybe more so, the elm yellows. And so the tree needs to have some level of disease or insect resistance. And the most recent examples would be, you know, ashes are such great trees, but not anymore because of the emerald ash borer that's pretty much wiped out, you know, every ash in the Northeast now. And then there's the hemlock woolly adelgid attacking one of the most beautiful trees in New York, the eastern hemlock. And so you should be aware of some of the, you know, the good things that the trees can provide and also some potential liabilities.
We get asked at the Catskill Forest Association often about planting southern trees because of, you know, maybe some climate change going on. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, there are organizations, you know, that are called things like the National Arbor Association that are making that same point. And I think it's really not a good idea yet, because what happens with, if you think about some of the things that are happening with the change of climate, things are just getting more catastrophic, and not just the hurricanes and not just more tornadoes and bigger tornadoes, but major heat and cold events and drought events, they're getting more extreme. And so the temperatures might look like they're actually getting warmer. In the case of upstate New York, they're not. They're getting wetter. The climate has actually become wetter in the area around Syracuse and further north. In some places, it's warmer, but it doesn't account for these pulse events that happen every few years that are sometimes worse than ever before, and those are the events that keep things from living. And if you think about it, you know, trees, you know, if you're planting like a fruit crop or a perennial or an annual, it's not a big deal. But you've got an investment in a tree, and you're hoping to watch grow for 50 or more years. After maybe year five, some major event will happen and mow the tree down. And so I would not yet be planting forests that with the idea that they're adapted to climate change, because we're just still in that area, real erratic weather events.
Yeah, I was just at a property today. There was two dead and dying apricot trees, and she says that this is her second or third attempt at trying apricots here in the Catskill Mountains. I suggested maybe peaches if you want stone fruit, but it's not going to work.
Well, you know, the starting point is always you've got to look at the cold hardiness, and the tree has to be proven to be cold hardy at that low temp. And then to be safe, especially in mountainous terrain where topography can really change the actual temperature that's going to have the effect, then you know you don't want to go with something colder or more cold tolerant, not less cold tolerant.
Right. How do you feel about zone maps and how accurate they are? Because this woman I was speaking to specifically mentioned that she ordered it from a company that said, no, this should work for your zone. It clearly it's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on the company. I mean, I know of a fruit and nut tree company that I've ordered stuff from, and when you order, they tell you what your horticultural zone is, and every time I see the information they give me, they're a really fine scale. I mean, we're in this area where we're in horticultural zone, you know, 5A, and so they just don't tell you it's 5, but they give you a little bit fine tuning. And I think that information is based on, I think it's updated every 10 years, so it's not like these maps are based on information from 100 years ago. It's based on updated information because, you know, in Syracuse, when I first came here 35 years ago, we were averaging 110 inches of snow winter, and now we're up to 124, I think. So, you know, these things have to be updated, and they are updated. But there's nothing really better as long as it's a reputable, you know, it's the USDA cold hardiness map, or there are a few others out there, but, you know, you want to use something that is highly reputable.
And so what are some specific challenges that a tree has to be able to tolerate in a urban context?
Well, in urban context, you know, it's a different ballgame than if a tree is in a park or in a yard and it's not near asphalt, it's not near roads. And in upstate New York, one of the big challenges is salinity tolerance. And there are trees that are tolerant to salinity, but there are a lot of trees that aren't. For example, our beautiful eastern white pine, not only is it not tolerant of salt runoff, but it's also not tolerant to salinity that is in aerosol, so that, you know, as cars go down major roads like 17, they throw a lot of those aerosols laden with salt in the air. And so you can see the effect of, you see this in Syracuse all around, all these trees that are planted in the heart of Syracuse on both sides of I-81, they have this really distinct witch's brooming. And witch's brooming is typically associated with certain species and caused by a certain factor. But in this case, it's all the trees, it's all the species, and it's all caused by salinity. So salinity is really one of the most serious issues now, but more generically, street trees or urban trees have real serious problems with the typical compacted soil associated with urban areas and compacted soils. So a normal soil would be 50% pore space, which would be oxygen, and 50% soil space or soil particles. But when you have these soils that are so compacted, you've got so little pore space to begin with. When you start, you know, when you have flooding events or really dry conditions, then you really start to get some serious problems because of that. That soil is so unique in urban environments. So probably the compacted soil and salt tolerance is or salt intolerance are really two big things to keep in mind when you do urban tree plantings.
Yeah, we see that on the side of Route 28, State Route 28, just coming from High Mount towards Arkville, and there's white pines on the side of the road adjacent to the road that are dying back from salt. You can see that for sure.
Yeah, and so you think about, if you think of different pines, there are pines with really thin needles, and eastern white pine is probably one of the best examples. Then there are pines like our native pitch pine and our native red pine that the needles are really thick. And those thicker needle pines, I mean, it's not that you can't plant trees along the roads, but if you've got a road, you want an evergreen screen, you need to select a thick needle pine, like pitch pine and red pine would be fine. You see red pine throughout the Adirondacks along the most the busiest roads with a ton of salt on both sides, and they're pretty tolerant of a high amount of salinity.
I guess that makes sense because, you know, you find those in New Jersey along the coast, pitch pine, doing well.
Absolutely.
And
you think about, like, Japanese black pine, which is a common ornamental. It's real common on Long Island escaping cultivation. These are trees that, in many cases, they've actually adapted to the seaside habitats, and so they just don't have any problem with salinity.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Best Trees for Home, Urban, and City Landscapes in the Northeast with Dr. Don Leopold. He's from the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. So, trees to avoid in urban areas. We'll start with that first.
Well, you know, whenever when you hear these, you tell people that a certain tree is not really good, it's amazing. It's like you're insulting their dog. It is. I don't know how many people have gotten upset because, you know, I'll say something like, you know, box elder is really a bad tree for most planted situations. Now, in its native streamside habitat, it's a wonderful tree. Provides really important habitat, you know, really good shade for streams, for the, you know, great trout fishing that's in the Catskills. But in an urban context or in a yard, I mean, it has nothing to offer other than leaves. I mean, there's nothing special about the leaves, and they don't usually even turn much in the fall. So, sometimes they do. But there's no flowers to get excited about. They put out a ton of pollen. They actually start to, you know, your nose will start to twitch in mid-March because these start to bloom then. And so they only live about 50 years, and then they look fine on the outside, but they might be rotten on the inside. And so silver maples, they're both native trees, and in their native habitat, they're really important trees because they have great ecological functions. But in terms of if you're going to spend money on a tree for any purpose, you know, they're not particularly good trees, and I would avoid those. I'd also avoid any of these trees that have these known liabilities at this time, like very distinct insect or disease problems.
Zane, you have any trees that to avoid, you think?
To avoid? No.
One comes to mind here in the Catskills is the spruce.
Spruces? Yeah, blue spruce for sure.
Yeah.
It's always seemed to have needle cast issues with blue spruce. But yeah, I think it's effect of just the moisture and the longer growing season. A tree like that, I think it usually likes it high and dry.
Do you guys have issues in Syracuse with blue spruce?
We do see needle cast problems on occasion. There are three spruces native to New York, red spruce, white spruce, and black spruce. And all three are in the Catskills, although red is probably the most common. Unfortunately, those don't look particularly good in the landscape. They're sort of higher elevation species. They're pretty moisture demanding. And so you've got this blue spruce, besides that beautiful blue color, if you get the bluer forms, it's probably one of the most drought-tolerant spruces in the world. It's actually found in the lower montane zone of the Rockies, and it's really well adapted to the northeastern environment, and that's why it's the most commonly planted spruce. But with this needle cast issue starting to show up, I think people need to be a little bit more careful. There are an awful lot of them. That tree, I've seen them in their native stands. I mean, that tree will get 5-6 feet in diameter. It'll get 800 years old. I mean, it's a really beautiful tree to walk in stands of. But it really, there are a lot of trees that we overplant in the Northeast as if, people are only think that there's only like 10 options when, in fact, there's literally hundreds of options when you start talking about native and non-native tree species.
And so you talked about additional considerations at your talk for the International Society of Arboriculture. Can you go into that?
Well, a lot of, besides the people expecting flowers and nice looking fruit and good fall color, we're trying to create it's called a forest food system where you put together a bunch of trees, shrubs, and herbaceous species that, besides their ecological function, they also provide food, especially in places where food security is a real issue. And we have a lot of folks from other countries in Syracuse who forage in the city and outside the city for plants, in ditches and other places, and taking fish from Onondaga Lake that aren't necessarily the healthiest to eat. And so what we're trying to, there's a group of us trying to think of ways to take vacant lots, of which we've got many of, over 1,000 in Syracuse, and instead of just leaving them barren, trying to figure out ways that we can plant native or non-native, if needed, tree shrubs and herbaceous species that yield food products. And probably the one that people are surprised by, because it tastes like a tropical fruit, because it's from a tropical family, is the pawpaw. Pawpaw is actually native to New York, and it's perfectly hardy in Syracuse. It would grow in most places in the Catskills except the highest elevations. And pawpaw is a substantial fruit. I mean, some of them can weigh 0.5 pounds. And it's like a big swollen banana that tastes like a little bit like a pineapple custard yogurt mixed with mango. It's a pretty amazing fruit, and it's very nutritional. So some of these trees that have great flowers and great fall color and form, they really can provide this extra benefit, food value in the fall. Persimmon's another one, native to New York. I mean, if you've never had a persimmon, they're so much better than the ones that you buy that are from the markets that are so much bigger, but they're more like, it's like a green tomato. It just doesn't have the flavor that our native persimmon does. But persimmon, if you've never had it, tastes like an overripe apricot soaked in honey. It is just almost sickening sweet.
Now, I'm familiar with shagbark hickory. I've eaten those nuts quite often. They're great. But you talked about shellbark hickory. Can we grow that in New York State?
Yeah, if you're a fan of shagbark, you'll never eat another shagbark if you can find some shellbark. Now, the problem is in New York State, it only occurs in one place naturally, and that's south of one of the Finger Lakes. But it's a very rare tree, but it's not because it doesn't grow here. In fact, if you look at the distribution of that tree and some other species, it looks like it has its distribution is somehow tied into Native American settlements, and it's a much bigger nut. It's twice the size of shagbark, and it tastes more like a tastes more like butter pecan ice cream that isn't particularly sweet. It's just really delicious.
Which Finger Lake is this growing near?
So it's the base of Owasco. There's one bottom land, and it's the only place that we know of. Well, there are, occasionally they like people will send me a sample that's shell bark, and it's not from there. So we know it's elsewhere in the state, but it is one of our rarest trees, and it is really one of our most delicious. Now, there are places that sell fruit and nut trees that actually sell that. I don't think they make a big fuss about how native it is, but it is really a choice tree. Now, if you're going to plant it, you're not going to get a big crop the next year. It's typical of oaks and hickories and other trees that take, a few decades to start cranking out the fruit production.
Now, I'm very curious about the shell bark. Actually, I visit Owasco Lake a lot, so kind of curious now. What's it look like?
So first of all, it's a wetland tree, unlike shed bark. You'll find shed bark in wetlands further south, but in the northeast, shed bark's really an upland species and usually on the drier sites. So shell bark will be mixed in with like green ash and other bottomland species. So if you know shed bark, it's got five leaflets, and the stem, the new growth is past, like this winter, the growth is kind of dark. If you look at shell bark, the stem is fatter. It's got a longer bud, and if you look at the rachis on the ground, you'll see seven distinct leaflet scars instead of five. And so it's pretty consistently a seven leaflet hickory. And the other issue is it looks just like shagbark hickory in terms of the shaggy bark, right, but the ridges are wider. So it tends to, like, it's not as disconnected from the tree as the shagbark hickory bark is, but they're very similar.
Now, you said it grows like green ash. Does that mean that it grows in floodplains or like where it's well-drained alluvial soil, or can it tolerate poorly drained soil?
So here's an example of a tree that will grow. Well, first of all, it's a wetland tree. It's actually, I think it's a wetland, probably a facultative wetland species. So it's truly a wetland species.
Wow.
So I saw it a lot in the Midwest in these uplands that have these hard pans, and so you get these flooded areas from spring snow melt and runoff. But it's also on floodplains. It's very common on floodplains. But where you'll see it a lot, I've seen it a lot in parks and cemeteries and other places where it is absolutely not wet at all. So a lot of these floodplain trees thrive on very dry upland conditions, whereas a lot of the upland species don't thrive in the floodplain conditions because they have different adaptations for those environments.
So could I recommend this tree to replace, like, swamp white oak?
Well, it's very similar to swamp white oak in terms of habitat. Many Midwestern stands where I've seen it, those two would be side by side. So,
that's good to know.
As far as conditions, as far as longevity, I mean, the shellbark hickory will live 400 years like shellbark. They're like shellbark hickory. The main difference is that the hickories tend to have almost across all species nice yellow fall color. And swamp white oak, as great as that tree is, it doesn't have any fall color. I've seen 1,000 of them, never has fall color. They both are very nice together. If you've got a wetland setting, those two would be great complements.
Would it also grow like with black gum as well? Or is it?
Absolutely.
I'm just trying to.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there are places where shell bark is more common, you would actually see it growing with black gum when it occurs in wetlands. Black gum is like red maple.
Yeah.
It'll occur in a wetland. It'll be on a ridgetop. I mean, they are really everywhere in the landscape.
Good. Yeah. Okay. So now I think I'm figuring out the site. Zane, that'd be a good tree to recommend to members of the Catskill Forest Association in these poorly drained sites.
Yeah.
The only thing you need to just make sure the cold hardiness works out based on the site, that's all.
Yes, okay, so how cold hardy is it? Zone 5, 4, or more?
It's probably offhand, I don't have anything here to check it quickly, but I'm guessing it's a 4, but it certainly is a 5 because it's very common, up in the middle to upper Midwest.
Yeah, good. That's great for us. I mean, 4 is pretty good, and 5 is a lot of our region. So,
yeah, if you go to like the Stark Brothers Nursery Catalog, they show it in their catalog, and they'll show you the cold hardiness zone. And I think they're pretty reliable because they guarantee the trees, and they're not going to want to be replanting things for or paying replacing things for people.
Dan, you have something to say?
Well, I know a lot of our members really like those southern species, like the paw and persimmon. Is there any kind of small local site conditions that they should be aware of if they really want to make one thrive?
Well, so if you have a building, even if it's small, but the bigger the building, and if you plant trees like a persimmon on the south side of the building, you'll give you probably an extra whole zone of hardiness. So we've got a southern magnolia on our campus that normally you wouldn't plant, not southern magnolia, a sweet bay magnolia. And normally you don't see many of those in Syracuse, but we have it at the corner of our building. And it does great there because the building gives it a whole extra cold hardiness zone. We have persimmon growing in Syracuse at some private homes around the city here, and it puts out a lot of fruit in some of those cases. There are some in Ithaca that I go to many years to collect to bring back to class. So I think there's plenty of persimmons that are cold hardy. In fact, if you look at like pawpaw and persimmon and some of these catalogs, I think they list some increased, proven hardiness for some of these. So, but you can get extra hardiness by where you place them. So the coldest part of any yard would be the north-facing shaded part. If you want to try to put some of these more sensitive species, you want to try the south side or the western side. That's only a problem when you get into evergreens, where you have to be careful about doing that because then you have some winter leaf scorch problems.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is best trees for home, urban, and city landscapes in the Northeast with Dr. Don Leopold. So I want to ask you about native versus non-native and how objective or subjective are these terms?
Well, I've been giving talks about native plants for 25 years, and for a while people would often challenge you about, well, that's not native or whatever, but these are not subjective terms. They're very specific terms that have a defendable definition. So native, used by most people, is a plant that was in an area historically prior to European settlement. And so that's different than exotic, and some exotic species are also invasive. So they're both not true. So all invasives aren't exotics, and all exotics aren't invasives. So there's a subset of exotics, like Scotch pine, which I think is probably naturalizing along some roads in the Catskills. Scotch pine is definitely not native. It's spread through most of Eurasia. But it's naturalizing here, which means it's coming up on its own, and it's doing fine. But it's not invading stands and taking over native species. So not all exotic species are necessarily bad. The ones that are bad are the ones that are famous, like Norway maple and the shrub autumn olive and plants that really just absolutely take over any forest or any natural area because they're more competitive than our native species.
Yeah. I mean, how much of this do you think it has to do with, people either overplanting it, deer browse, lack of forest management? Plus or minus?
Well, I think, a basic problem is a lack of knowledge about what plants are native or not. And that's the starting point. And you would hope that you could rely on the person selling the plants wouldn't sell you something that was going to be a problem. But as you know, that's not always the case. So I think that's what I've been trying to do for the last 30, 40 years is to let people know, you don't have to, you have more than five choices when it comes to planting a tree. I mean, you have hundreds of choices, and sometimes you have to go to a nursery that maybe you weren't thinking about in order to get some of those other choices. But there's also the New York State Prohibitive Plant Law, which includes some of these tree species. It includes the Norway maple. It includes the Calorie pear. So there are some documents that are out there that are trying to inform people that, you should know what you're planting. You shouldn't be buying a Calorie pear and act like you've never heard it was a problem, because it's a problem. So some nurseries will still sell those, In fact, I've been to a number this summer where they had tags on the plants saying this is a prohibitive plant, and we're required to tell you this, but you can still buy it, so which just seems kind of odd. But
yeah. Well, we're going to take a break, and up next, we'll ask Dr. Leopold about small native trees that you recommend planting.
The people in the city call me country because of how I walk and talk and smile. Well, I don't mind them laughing in the city, but the country folks all say I'm city-fied. The fighting men may say that I'm a coward because I never push no one around. Gentle people call me troublemaker, 'cause I'll always fight and stand my ground. Funny, I don't fit. Where have all the average people gone? Some pious people point and call me sinner, because to them I've never seen the light. Other folks think of me as a preacher, I'm just doing what I think is right. The wealthy people think that I am a hobo, lean and hungry, writing mournful songs. And the poor, poor people think I am a rich man, but really, I'm just trying to get along. Yes, it's funny, I don't fit. Tell me where have all the average people gone? Yeah, the government has given me a number to simplify my birth and life and death, and still my woman thinks I'm all important, like moon and sun and sea and sky and breath. Yes, it's funny, I don't fit. Where have all the average people gone? Funny, I don't fit. Where have all the average people gone?
All right, it's Roger Miller. He's always whistling. Where have all the average people gone? This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. And we have guest host Zane Lawyer, also on from the Catskill Forest Association. And Zane, didn't you take a course with Dr. Leopold?
Yeah, as an undergraduate, Dr. Leopold, your dendrology course was the first class I ever took at ESF there.
Well, let me look up your grade here that I've got in front of me.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, does this guy know anything about trees, Dr. Leopold? No answer. That means you don't know anything, Zane. So,
but I enjoyed the course. I know that you do a lot of your own photography. I know in your books you have a lot of your own photographs of plants you've seen.
Yeah, I think as an undergrad, I borrowed a camera from a professor. I went to the Arnold Arboretum to take pictures of trees, and I'll never forget, it was a film camera, and after going through the whole Arboretum, it turned out that my film wasn't on the take-up spool, so I had no photos of the trees. But since then, I've acquired about 50,000 color images, more recently digital. And I there's something about, you know, when you look at plants through a lens, especially close-up and other features, you really see things that you start to better understand the differences among species. So I think just a natural thing to either draw or to or photograph plants or any biota, I think, help you learn the features of those of that biota.
What's the hardest you've ever worked to get a perfect shot of a tree and flower or the perfect specimen you found along the road?
I don't know about working hard, but I'll never forget I was driving along the Blue Ridge Parkway just outside the Smokies, and I saw a beautiful, it was full bloom along the roadside of Fraser Magnolia, Magnolia Fraserii, and these are flowers that are a foot in diameter. And it's a sub-canopy tree, so it was easy to reach. It was right at eye level. And I broke a branch off, and I was photographing it. And behind me, I saw some blue lights come on. It was the Blue Ridge Park police who was very upset that I broke the branch off. And, of course, you can't tell them that, you know, this isn't going to make any difference at all to anything. But so that took a little bit of time to get out of. It's always fun. I look back at a lot of the images, not just thinking about that plant, but also the circumstances behind it.
So what are some small native trees you recommend planting in the urban landscape?
You know, decades ago, the single most common tree to recommend for landscape planting was not necessarily for urban, because with the compacted soils, this would not be a good recommendation, but that was flowering dogwood. And a lot of people who study plants and trees all their lives, you know, regard this as maybe our most beautiful native tree of any size. But like a lot of our native species, this is another one affected by disease. In this case, it's the anthracnose, and it really is wiping this tree out throughout a good portion of its range, also the Appalachians. And so, instead of the flowering dogwood, one might think about species or hybrids with the Chinese dogwood, Cornus cuza. They've been hybridized by a professor at Rutgers decades ago, and they've produced these hybrids that have some of the best features of these dogwoods. So for small trees, you know, the dogwoods are really great, but there's one that is worth looking for, and I haven't seen it that commonly for sale, but if there's ever an opportunity for a nursery person to sell these, I think the nanny berry, it's a viburnum, a native viburnum, and it has the size of a flowering dogwood. It's small stature, but there's another tree with beautiful flowers, fruit, fall color, form, alligator hide bark. It's drought resistant, it's flood resistant. I mean, it is really a fine tree, and I think this is one of those that if the public saw more often, I think they would be asking, you know, for it more often from nursery people.
What do you think about Eastern Redbud? I can't help but recommending that to people. It's got beautiful flowers early in the spring before the leaves come out, and the leaves are always kind of this fall color of, like, just really, like, highlighter yellow.
Yeah, Eastern Redbud's a really beautiful native tree. Now, it's not native to New York. Here's an example where there's a tree that is not far away as far as nativeness, but it's widely naturalized in New York. So you see it. I was just down in Ithaca this weekend, and on the side of the road, you see all these red buds that in the spring are spectacular. It reminds me of the Midwestern forest where you have two layers of understory trees, the flowering dogwood and the Eastern Redbud. Eastern Redbud has great fall color. You can even eat the pods right after they're pollinated and they're still not leathery. You can stir fry those. So it's a great tree. There's really no downside to it. There's no insect disease problem. And it does naturalize, but it's not wiping out our native a flora, so that's a great recommendation, I think, for any place that it's cold hardy.
And what about this smoke tree? I see it up the road on my road, and it seems to be doing great.
Well, you know, smoke tree is native to the Midwest, so it has some level of nativeness depending on the geographical area you're talking about. It's a lot like the smoke bush, Cotinus cadigrea, from Europe, which has a lot of forms. In fact, some of those forms now are being selected because they're naturally small. They're being selected for street tree plantings. And the genus of Cotinus is fairly drought-tolerant, and so they're also very small by nature. So for many reasons, they're worth considering. The smoke tree has a leaf that is kind of rounded, and it's sort of blue-green during the summer, but then in the fall, it's almost always no matter what the selection is. The fall color is outstanding. The actual flowers are rather interesting, but they're not spectacular. They're just very interesting. But it's being more and more planted because of its stature, its lack of problems, and its drought hardiness.
You guys have any more questions about recommended native small trees?
Well, I find ginkgo always kind of, well, not native tree, but ginkgo's more of a large tree, I guess. But I always found that to be a really good tree to plant, and same beautiful fall color, and it's just kind of a eye-catching tree. It's just because it's so exotic, its old form.
Yeah, so ginkgo is probably one of the most bulletproof of all trees at any size from anywhere in the world. The only issue is that one has to make sure they're getting the male selection, one of the male cultivars. And there are many that if you grow it from seed, you know, 40 years after you've invested a lot and the tree starts to get a good size, if it's a female and then start producing those fruits, at least in places where there's traffic, foot traffic, or car traffic, it can be really obnoxious in terms of the smell. Now, it's also one of the most delicious seeds and nutritional seeds you can find. If once you get past that fruit, you can roast the seeds for 10 minutes in oil and salt, and they're very good. I mean, I've told people what they taste like. It doesn't sound good, but it's like a cross between a peanut and fish. They're just so unusual. So ginkgo's a great tree, but that's not that tree. I've seen the biggest one outside of Japan. I mean, it's probably 5-6 feet in diameter, not circumference. It is a huge tree, and so you need to be aware of that if you start putting them underneath utility lines.
So what do you mean by it's a bulletproof tree?
Well, bulletproof in terms of, you know, you can't kill it with, there's no insect or disease or pollution or salinity. It's one of probably the most tolerant of the widest range of urban conditions that you can think of. So there aren't that many in that category that also have really great ornamental attributes. That foliage during the summer kind of looks like, it's also called a maidenhair tree because it looks like the maidenhair fern. But in the fall, it's really so neat when that beautiful golden or yellow fall color comes on. And as soon as it peaks on the tree, within 3 days, it just simultaneously, all the leaves fall off together. So in terms of maintenance issues, it's a great tree because unlike oaks that the leaves shed for, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 weeks, the leaves turn fall color and they're gone within 3 to 4 days. You clean them up and that's it. So there are a lot of really good reasons to recommend ginkgo.
Before we move on to medium-sized trees, any more honorable mention for small trees recommended?
Well, for small, one of my favorites that is not native because it is so easy to grow and it is so, it looks like a Cadillac, and that's the paper bark maple, Acer chrysium. And, you know, I've seen some in Syracuse here that, you know, it's clear that a truck has run into it and half the side is gone and the tree just keeps on growing in these real narrow medians. And the fall color is incredible. It's sort of like burning bush, which is a real problematic shrub. But I think it's even more beautiful than burning bush. And it happens sort of the first week or two in November. It's very late. And then the bark is, there's nothing like the bark. It's one of the most beautiful barks in the world. And it's always very small. I mean, I've seen some really old ones, and it's really a small tree.
If you're just tuning in and you're listening to From the Forest, tonight's topic is best trees for home, urban, and city landscapes in the Northeast with Professor Dr. Don Leopold. So what are some medium-sized trees you would recommend?
Well, for just general planting, you know, for wet or dry and some shade or full sun, you want some nice fall color and the flower display isn't too bad. It's not spectacular, but the red maple, which is one of our most common trees in the East, is pretty hard to beat. It's it doesn't live as long as some of the oaks, but it's a very functional tree that you don't have to worry so much about the site conditions for it to continue to thrive. There are a lot of others, like the Eastern Red Cedar for a small evergreen. There are some issues with the cedar apple rush. You know, if you're near an orchard, you probably shouldn't be planting it, but cedar, the Juniperus virginiana, Eastern Red Cedar, is remarkably salt tolerant. It doesn't tolerate any shade, And there's some really neat horticultural forms. But it's really a great functional tree. Birds love it for habitat and for food. As far as a non-native tree for the landscape, if it's not real dry, I think the Japanese tatsura is, it's one of the most important timber trees in Japan. I'd love to see it in those native stands. It's got a leaf that looks like redbud, but it's half the size, maybe a quarter of the size. It's more blue-green, great fall color, but it won't do real well along the street. It's just not incredibly drought-tolerant, so you have to be careful, where you plant it. But there are some small maples that are medium-sized, like the Triton maple, Acer bergerianum, and some others that are being used more and more in cities. Acer compestri, the hedge maple, that really make good street trees, and they tolerate a lot of bad conditions.
What do you guys think?
I've seen a Japanese maple a few times, but I know it's kind of very sensitive to wind.
Japanese maples, they're literally hundreds and hundreds of cultivars, and you can spend your whole life, and our people spend their whole life just collecting the Japanese maple, Acer palmatum, or the other Japanese maples, Japonicum, and others. And they are spectacular trees in terms of their ornamental characteristics. So many varieties, different leaf colors, different leaf textures, forms, whatever, but it's kind of a fussy tree. If you've got a protected spot, that's a great tree for a protected spot. I wouldn't put it out where it's fully exposed to the elements. It does have to have a good amount of sunlight, so you can't put it in a protected spot that's really shaded, because then the colors won't develop, and it can't be in a poorly drained soil. But that is one really fun group to look for cultivars, as we've been doing lately. It's just like there's such good variety, and I had a colleague here years ago that I think had about 150 cultivars in his rock garden, so you can pack a lot in a small space.
What about this Amur cork tree? I think I saw this at the Arboretum at Harvard. Some big ones.
Well,
there.
That photograph that I showed might have been from that tree at Harvard, the Arboretum. So if you're really looking for a place to see trees in their best, the New York Botanical Gardens is a fine place, the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, Harvard's Arboretum in Jamaica Plains. The Amur cork tree is really very showy. It tends to be a little bit big for immediately adjacent to streets, but for a park where it has a chance to really sprawl, because it's a low branching tree by nature, usually multiple stem, it is really a beautiful tree. There's nothing spectacular about the foliage. It's the compound leaves that are bright green, no great fall color, but that cork-like bark is really interesting.
So, Dr. Leopold, this hour is flying by. We only have 4 minutes left, and that leaves us with recommended large trees.
Well, the oaks are what a great group of both native and non-native species. So, and there are a lot of oaks that are well-known, like Northern Red Oak. But there's some other oaks, like the Chinquapin Oak, Quercus muhlenbergii, which really is a beautiful tree. Quercus schumardii, the Schumard Oak. So there are a lot of really neat oaks. It's a matter of finding them. The Kentucky Coffee Tree, that's another rare tree in New York State. Beautiful shade tree. It's not a real dense shade, so you can have a nice lawn under it. Black maple. I mean, there's so many big trees that, and even the tree like bald cypress, not native to New York, native to New Jersey, southern New Jersey, but bald cypress, for a tree that can grow 2,700 years and permanently stand in water, that's a pretty neat tree, but you don't have to put it in a pond in order to grow it. So a lot of options for large trees, native or not, in the landscape.
Black maple is really interesting when you went into that at the conference, at New York State Arborist Conference, because it's, Acer nigrum, I think it is. I think it's native to the Lake States more so, just like sugar maple, but it's more drought tolerant, you said?
Yeah, so if you look at the geographical range map of trees, those maps sometimes suggest what some of these plants can tolerate. So this black maple goes out so much further west into the drier Midwest, way out into Iowa, where sugar maple is really confined to more mesic regions. It's the same size. I've seen the biggest one in Indiana. It's like 97 feet tall. It's 4 feet in diameter. There's one at Letchworth I've seen that's probably 4 or 5 feet in diameter. It cranks out the sap just like the sugar maple. The main difference is simply the leaves look droopy, and they have a different fall color. It's still nice, but it's just different than sugar maple. But otherwise, go up to upstate New York on these limestone-based soils. It's very common, especially on limestone bedrock.
Yeah, I find them once in a while here, but they're very rare.
Yeah.
What do you think about yellow poplar? We recommend that tree all the time.
Well, yellow poplar is the state tree for three states, and there's no other tree that I can think of that maybe there's one others like that. So that tells you that this is one heck of a tree. It's a huge tree. I've seen the biggest in the country. The only downside is that sometimes people will put this tree as a sapling in a small yard, and then this thing, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk. Everything just grows so quickly and becomes so big. But the foliage, whether the summer or fall, it's beautiful. The flowers are extraordinary. The fruit isn't much to get excited about, but that beautiful, symmetrical, long, clear, straight bowl, it is really a great tree.
Yeah, it's we recommend it, you know, not only for the things you just said, but it's just so straight growing that less maintenance than some other trees. You know, like a maple tree, when it's open grown, it gets the structural defects a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But man, is it a beautiful looking tree.
It is.
So we got about a minute left. Any other honorable mentions for large trees?
Well, as far as non-native, that is a really fun category to look at the varieties, is the European beech. There's just so many neat forms, cut leaf forms and pendulous forms, and it's just a monster tree over time. And the other one that I would mention that a lot of people, when they see for the first time, they're always struck by it, is the Dawn Redwood Metasequoia glyphostroboides. It's just got such, I mean, it's basically the deciduous version of the coastal redwood, and we can't grow one of the most spectacular trees in the world in New York because it's too cold, but you can grow something that just about looks like it in terms of cone and foliage and form.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think I saw those at the Arboretum at Harvard. I can't remember. What's the name of it? Arnold Arboretum.
Yeah, the Arnold Arboretum. It's definitely worth a visit. If you're ever over in the Boston area, definitely worth a visit.
Well, we can't thank you enough for coming on. I learned a lot. I have to have you on again. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, have a good night. And if you missed the show, that was Dr. Donald Leopold from SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, and we're talking about best trees for the home, urban, and city landscapes in the Northeast. That's all I have, and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town,